we'll get started again.
But it works.
My name is Ramesh Thakur. I work here at CG. I'm one of the co-chairs for this conference. I'd like to extend my personal welcome to all of you and thank you for attending this important conference. Having done that as co-chair, I will also take myself off first thing in the morning for tomorrow, so you won't hear me then. But I'd like to introduce the speakers and the chair for this session. I'll go in order in terms of their proximity to me and then come back to the chair. Rolf Alter, he's the Chief of Staff to the Secretary General of the OECD, not to the OECD, as the program says. Next to him, Paul Heinbecker, who used to be our ambassador to the United Nations, is now a colleague with me here at CG as a distinguished fellow, and also teaches at Wilfrid Laurier University with a cross appointment there. Next to Paul, Andres Rosenthal, unless he's passed over that as well, president of the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations, a former Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs of Mexico. It's a trio of very distinguished and extinguished diplomats there. Next to Andres is Gordon Smith, who is now the Executive Director of the Center for Global Studies at University of Victoria out in British Columbia, and the former Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs of Canada. And then at the far end of the table, Shui Lan, who is the Executive Associate Dean of the School of Public Policy at Tsinghua University. The reason I don't need any piece of paper before me in introducing them, we've all been working together on a very interesting project that they will talk about, which has to do with global leadership in resolving some of these major bottlenecks, including questions of climate change and energy security. And to moderate the panel, to moderate the session, we have someone who is extremely familiar to all of us in Canada by name, by face, and by voice, Diana Swain. And the reason she is very familiar to all of us in Canada for the foreign guests here is that she is the anchor of the main nightly evening, weeknightly broadcast on CBC, the public broadcasting system. Diana, over to you.
As a television journalist, I'm just vain enough to think you're actually clapping for me. But I know by looking at the program, as I'm sure you have, you're clapping because this is the last panel and after that the bar opens. And I
could call it all off right now.
Done panels often enough to know that you position yourself to go right before the open bar because then people are on the edge of their seats and you can confuse yourself and think that they're so engaged in what you're saying that they're really captivated, but they're really just ready to be the first ones there when we say the cocktail reception begins. What we want to do with this panel is different than the way the other panels have been formatted. So instead of opening statements, we're going right to the Q&A, and I'm the Q. As a journalist, nothing is more enticing to me than the offer to interview five people on a topic like this. So that's the way we're going to do it. And toward the end of our allotted time, assuming that we will still have time left, we're trying to shorten this to get ourselves back on schedule, we'll open this up to the floor. I should also mention that Rolf has an obligation to leave at about 5:30, is that right, Rolf, to catch a plane. So he may be sort of sneaking out. It's not because my questions have become just that powerful, but I'll interpret it that way. What we want to do then is talk about the role of global political leadership. I think if nothing else today, what's been established is that there is some consensus, at least in this room, about the need for something to be done. There's consensus about the seriousness of the problem, consensus about what has caused it by and large, that there is a need for action now and that the clock is ticking. The question then becomes not whether we should move forward, but how. What is the mechanism? What is the role of global political leadership and through what forum? And do we need a new one to do it? There has been a lot of discussion at CG and with other organizations that they've partnered with around the globe to try to figure out if something new is needed. And one of the things that's emerged out of that is this talk about, in fact, another global organization referred to so far as the L14. And just for those who may not have been a part of this discussion or had the opportunity to read some of the research beforehand, it's essentially the G8 plus the five other countries that are sort of loosely referred to as the plus five, China, Brazil, South Africa, Mexico, and India. This new incarnation would also add Egypt, so there would be sure representation from an Islamic country. You get out of all of that the L14. The idea being that they would be equal members, but that this particular body would deal with the issues of climate change and energy security. So that's where I want to begin. And as a journalist, we seemed only appropriate that I would take the adversarial role here. That's my natural comfort zone. So that's how we're going to try to work this panel, is not just to let the speakers have their say, but to let me challenge them as best I can with my knowledge, which really doesn't approach those of you in the room. So we'll get to you later. But to get some back and forth in this discussion so we can get an engagement on how we move forward from here. To that end, I want to start with you, Gordon, because I know how strongly you feel about the L14 idea. So let's get to that. Is what this discussion needs really another body that could be bogged down in politics? And I know you feel strongly that it must be the leaders who participate in this. Is that feasible? Is the mechanics of getting all of these people in one place to talk about this even realistic? And is it going to take so long that we'll completely forget the need for urgency?
Yeah, we're bogged down now. That's the problem. And, I mean, it's clear with the kind of discussions we've had today. I mean, anybody, as far as I know, that really believes that the UN process, with its next big engagement being in Bali, is going to lead to a result of the kind that's necessary to deal with the climate change and energy issues and development issues that we're talking about today. I mean, anybody who believes that, I think, I wonder what they've been smoking. It's not going to get there. The only way we're going to get there is if there is a strong leadership from people at the top. Part of the reason is because these issues cut across a whole variety of sectors in government. You know, environment ministers, energy ministers, foreign ministers. But ultimately, the only people that can really make the kind of deals that are necessary to deal with issues of this breadth are leaders. The present G8 is too small. It doesn't have the right countries. You've got to go at least with China and India. And as you say, what we've been working on is adding the five countries that have been meeting with the G8 plus an Islamic country. Yes, it can be done. And yes, it can be done quickly.
All right, let me ask Andres then, to be trite about it. We talked about it yesterday as the cool new club, that you might get buy-in from member nations by saying, this is the new thing in the 21st century. This is the new G8. And you get to be a full member from the outset. But here's the price of admission. You have to change the way you do things. And membership means you get to go back to your population and tell them that there's going to be a new carbon tax or that they've got to change the way they live. How likely is it that nations such as Mexico or China would say they would be willing to pay that price of admission to be a part of this club?
I think we look at this from different perspectives, depending on the country concerned. In the case of my country, climate change and the need for a major modification of lifestyle and of way of doing things is an issue which has been pretty much accepted by not only public opinion, but by the leadership. And within the G5 or the O5 or whatever you want to call them, I think Mexico takes a middle-of-the-road position. We are not stuck in the debate that has taken place about who's at fault, who started this, what do we have to do. We are of the opinion that it's time to do it. We think that the G8 plus 5 format is the way to do it, because we, without being representative of countries or groups of countries, are large consumers and large polluters and large producers. And as a result of that, we probably would, if we were able to reach a decision on how to go about this, we would be able to satisfy at least a good proportion of the situation. Now, this is not necessarily true of all of the countries, either in the G8 or in the 5. Brazil and India have a rather different position. China has the position that you heard already twice today about the need to develop and therefore the need to use its coal resources, and that that is an overriding issue. But if it isn't through a group such as a G8 plus 5, where you can thrash these things out and come up with commitments, we will be stuck or deadlocked on these issues for quite some time. And just to mention, when you talk about the role of political leadership, there are two types of roles. There's a negative role and there's a positive role. The negative role are the leaders who refuse to take difficult decisions for political reasons, abdicating, in effect, the leadership role, or who use political decisions as tools or instruments of foreign policy in the energy sector. Witness what's gone on in Eastern Europe in terms of supply of gas, for example, to Western Europe. And then you have the positive leadership, the positive leaders who try to move the agenda forward, who try to find, in the case, for example, of climate change, a way of moving the agenda rather than talking at cross purposes.
I know from sitting at a table with Julien, who's sitting at the end of the table now, mm-hmm. and watching your reactions today to some of these presentations, in particular those that reference China, mm-hmm. how would China feel about being invited to take part in the L14 with the understanding that the whole express purpose mm. is to reduce consumption?
Well, I think if the whole purpose is reduce the consumption, I think actually China might not be the one that be most useful in terms of consumption. I think the per capita consumption of energy, I think China is only a very small fraction of those of developed countries. So I think getting to the fundamental question of sort of, you know, why Chinese leaders to participate, join the G5 and to participate in the G8. I think it's that I think the Chinese leaders have recognized that in terms of the future development, in terms of vision for China in the future, it's not a country of isolating itself. China has to be integrated with the world, has to develop it with the world. I think that's sort of, a vision of shared development. I think that's something that I think China have, over the past few centuries have waved back and forth. But I think for this generation of leaders, they've recognized that and they've really embraced globalization. So I think that's the first thing I'd like to say. And of course, I think that's probably not enough. I think China recognized that indeed there are many problems that really is sort of facing China facing the entire global community, and I think China wanted to engage in the dialogue, but at the same time, I personally feel that in order to really to come to global innovation in the governance, I think what this center is about. I think the next thing about leadership is empathy. I think that's what we really need, and I didn't see that in many of the discussion here. I think I wanted to share with, I'm someone who lived in China and studied and taught in the U.S. and went back to China. And I would say that empathy is the most important thing in building a dialogue. The empathy, that is, we've talked a lot about, strategies here and there. But the first thing is, let's think about developing countries. I'm thinking about the poor people in Guizhou province, in Qinghai, in the countryside and so on. The people who have not had the opportunity to even to use a light bulb. I think actually China's development over the last 30 years really brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And they really are able to enjoy many of the things that people here have taken granted for centuries. So I think in that part, I'm thinking of the people who are in Africa, in many, many other developing countries, who have not had the chance to experience the kind of development in China. But they may have to hope that to follow the models that of other, developed countries, like, developing countries and developed countries. So I think that we, in discussing about this, we really have to think about from another perspective from the countries that who are developing. So I think that's something that I'd like to mention. And this next thing I think is a political leadership means courage. I think there indeed, I think the courage of developing countries that would have to face the reality that China indeed is not able to enjoy the kind of lifestyle that's experienced here in the United States, Canada, and so on. And even though they may have the capabilities to do so, I think let me give one example. Lester Brown, who is a sort of well-known environmentalist, who once visited Tsinghua University, and I invited him to Tsinghua Forum, which is the highest academic forum in Tsinghua, to give a talk about his plan B of sustainable development. And in the in his talk, he rightly gave the arithmetics about why China could not follow the path of the U.S. of having family having cars, have its own single family house and so on. And because I, as my colleague, so the previous people, the speakers have mentioned that indeed, that would, consume probably most of the, oil supply. So after his, presentation, we organized a round table of Mr. Brown with, Tsinghua's Students Green Society. And to my surprise, his argument really angered a lot of the students of the Tsinghua Green Society. These are the people who are fighting for the environment. They are actually fighting for the sustainable development task. But one thing they are not in agreement with Mr. Brown is saying that, why on earth Chinese people could not have the right to enjoy the kind of lifestyle that other people can choose? Why couldn't we choose that? If we voluntarily decide we are not doing so, that's our right. But at the same time, we are not to be told by somebody we cannot do so.
Let me bring Paul Heinbecker in on this, because I guess this is the risk of... didn't mean to startle you. This seems to be one of the dances that will be important in the diplomatic relationship of making this work. Is how does the West in particular not come across as high-minded? We used it all up. We polluted everything. We now realize things have to stop. So we want everybody to stop at once now.
I just, you may be able to tell from my voice that I have a cold. I asked that the table be kept clear so that there would be no damage. I think that I'll come back to your question, but I wanted to make one point because I had prepared a statement, and it was two lines long, and it was that there's too much leadership. We don't suffer from a lack of leadership. There's too much leadership. I went to Google, and I saw that there were 157 million entries for leadership. So it's obviously something that's preoccupying people. I think what we need is a little bit more discerning leadership. I mean, President Bush led us into Iraq. Vice President Cheney's leading us into Iran. Chavez is leading us down the garden path. Ahmadinejad is leading us to perdition. Castro, I'm not quite sure. I think he's finished leading, actually, which is not a bad thing. So I think, if I were, and I would say that, wouldn't I? But if I were looking for leadership and partnership together, let's just take a look around this room. If it wasn't for Jim Balsillie, there would be no CG. There would be no CIC. There would be no Balsillie School. I dare say there may not be a RIM in the nature that it is.
Paul, I could ask you to speak closer to the mic if
but
you don't mind.
There is also, and I think if Jim understands leadership, he also understands partnership probably as well as anybody. What we're needing in the international community is more partnership. We don't need people who think that leadership is making tough decisions and trying to impose them on everybody else. We need people to come together on these kind of things. I think I'd like to challenge something that Gordon said about the UN process. The UN process did, after all, bring us the Kyoto Agreement, which is the only agreement we have on climate change. it did bring us the convention also on climate change, and it's done a great deal. I happen to agree that we really do need to get the key countries together, because I think it's easier. But I don't think it comes at the cost of or otherwise at the expense of an organization that we actually need. The problem with the end of the Cold War is that we haven't renewed, as somebody said yesterday, our institutions. And so that's partly what we're trying to do now, outside of without the incentives of the damage of a Cold War or of an actual war. We're trying to sort of update things. But what we need is, we don't need somebody, a good, strong leader, who decides that climate change is a bad idea. We had one good, strong leader who thought climate change came from trees. Now we have another one who says he can't do anything because it might have an effect on his economy. But everybody else, you're all welcome to do that. So I think that, I don't know what your question was, actually. I've been talking for a couple minutes trying to remember, but I might as well just ask.
You were getting there, though. Is it the notion that how does the West prevent itself from being perceived as high-minded by countries such as China or other countries in the developing world who say, wait a minute, you're going to tell us we can't use coal at our discretion, that each home can't have a car in the driveway? You've had that for decades. Now it's not good anymore? How does the West pursue an argument that doesn't appear to be only in its own self-interest?
Well, obviously it leads. It says to itself, we created this problem. It's been in the process of being created since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. I found it striking when I was in the Kyoto negotiations that for some reason the developing countries weren't persuaded when we invited them to join us in making an equal sacrifice. So I think we have to, we have to do the kind of things we said we'd do. We knew in 1997 that there would be policy consequences for the level of reductions that we had taken, and we knew that that was only a down payment on what was to come later. But actually, we haven't done it. Now we're saying, but that Kyoto stuff, that doesn't work. Well, it's because we didn't do it. That's why it doesn't work. We had discussions in the previous panel on taxation of, on carbon tax, on cap and trade systems. I can tell you, I had that discussion in 1997. We haven't done anything since 1997 about talk how difficult it is to do this. So if we're going to come across as not completely self-serving, I think we're going to have to do it ourselves first. It's obviously the case that you can't solve the climate change problem if China and India and others don't participate. But they're not going to participate on the basis of our evading our responsibilities.
I want to bring Rolf into this now, and from the perspective of the OECD being tasked with trying to kind of broker this new arrangement, at least the one that exists now between the G8 and the plus five. If time is of the essence, and Paul says he was talking with people about carbon tax 10 years ago, how likely is it that you'll be able to get some kind of a framework, whether it's the one that exists right now or something new, to be productive soon enough to meet the test of what needs to happen?
I think that there's no reason to be not optimistic, for the simple fact that it's quite natural that a group of countries like the G8 existed in the 80s. It was created with a similar idea: provide some sort of structure and leadership to the world economy. Only that at that time, the G8 reflected, in fact, the largest part of the world economy. In the meantime, the situation has changed dramatically to the benefit of those new countries. And not surprisingly, people who realize that whatever you decide in a G8 context to do, whether it's positive, difficult, politically loaded, it remains very limited because you forget five big major players in this economy. So the invitation is something that reflects just reality. Why would those countries buy into this concept? Certainly not if you had a single issue G13, L14, whatever. I don't think so. I think the advantages that you will develop over time, an agenda that fits the interest of all of those that are sitting at the table. It's not just climate change. And by the way, I mean, today you couldn't see better how vast this policy area already is. But look at it. China, India are countries that are asking for technology. They would like to make sure that investments continue to flow. They would like to see that they can actually trade, sell their stuff, be it services or goods. So they need a partner. And these are the other ones. So I think it's a mutual interest group that gets together and will make the decisions as they were always made. You broker a deal. It's not about imposing. It's about finding terms where everybody can say at the table, okay, I am sitting comfortably. I can speak to it. And then we will find out if we make a package, how can it be done? What's the time frame? Who pays? Can we make a little deal because we need something else? So it's not, I think, a new principle. It's just a principle that has grown with the fact of a very different global economy.
Gordon, I've seen you writing, so I know I don't have to prompt you with a question. Did you just want to...
Diana, what I wanted to do was to underline one word that is being was used just a few moments ago, empathy. And the importance that I think a lot of people that haven't had the good luck that I've had to be inside some of these meetings, the importance of interpersonal relationships. I don't know how many of you here have read Margaret Macmillan's superb Paris 1919, but you read that book and you see the relationship amongst the leaders at that time negotiating the settlement of World War One. Well, I mean, I've watched this sitting behind the Canadian Prime Minister inside the G8. I was there in the mid-90s. I watched the relationship between Bill and Boris, and that's what they called each other. I mean, there's an eye-to-eye contact that develops an understanding of the other position, of the position of the other, understanding of the need that, well, I have to give a bit here, he'll give a bit, or she'll give a bit somewhere else. But that the empathy is so necessary to produce agreements like this, but it's so hard to. You can't quantify this. A lot of historians, other than people like Margaret that are really superb at their work, don't get into this. Most of political science, in my view, doesn't get into this sort of soft stuff. But, I mean, from my own experience of watching leaders meet, this capacity to empathize is critical to achieving agreement.
Andres, I wanted to bring you into this discussion. I mean, how important, from your view, is the personal interaction between the people at the table? We heard former Prime Minister Paul Martin say to us yesterday that he thought it was critical that those relationships become something you learn to depend on. You develop a dialogue with each person, a bit of a give and take that you call on the next time you see them. Having said that, do you kind of surrender that a little bit by creating yet a new organization? Are you better to work within some existing bodies?
I do think, Diana, that it's critical, and I don't think it's only critical at the leaders' level. I think it's critical at every level in which international discourse takes place. It can be at the level of negotiators on a specific treaty. It can be at the level of deputy foreign ministers. I'm sitting here because this man on my right was my opposite number in Canada when I was deputy foreign minister, and we began a friendship that ended up in his bringing me in to several things here in Canada. I think it's critical that you have these personal relationships. The internet is fine for many things, but it's no good for negotiating. Negotiation requires eye-to-eye contact. It requires being able to deal with a human being in front of you, next to you, able to find those fine points that Gordon was talking about to find the common ground. And I mean, look, this isn't the first time that we are faced with critical issues that are unresolved. We've spent generations dealing with unresolved issues and resolving them little by little. Some have taken longer. Some have been quick to resolve. The climate change issue is an issue which is very difficult because it goes to the heart of the inequality of the world in which we live. If this was a world of equals, if we were all more or less had the same history and the same development process, we could easily come together and say, now is the time to do certain things. I remember when I was growing up, the United States automotive industry, every time a vehicle emission standard became... Is that mean I've got to stop? Every time,
times in a row we get
every time a vehicle emission standard was adopted in the United States for the automotive industry, they began to sell the old models, the polluting models, in Mexico. And this went on for years. Today, we have stricter emission standards in Mexico for our automobiles than 49 of the states of the United States, because we believe in the necessity of doing that, because we lived in circumstances which reached critical proportions in terms of the pollution of Mexico City and other urban areas. And I think that it is unfair to ask countries to forego certain parts of development, but it is fair to ask countries, China, India, Mexico, Brazil, to understand that the cost of not doing anything today increases exponentially the cost of having to do it tomorrow.
Zhu, I want to bring you into this because we heard from a Chinese journalist yesterday. Mm-hmm. We were all talking rather casually about how climate change plays in the media. Does it have any traction? Do people lead the newscast, headline their paper with climate change? And when we see that happening more and more here, the journalist that we spoke with was saying it really doesn't have that kind of traction right now in China. So how likely is it that these issues will be seen as critically, as Andres just mentioned?
I think the journalist is right. Indeed, I think probably not only China, but for many developing countries, climate change probably is not the most critical, most pressing, most immediate things that people or general public are concerned about. But at the same time, I think, you know, in China, in general terms, environmental pollution has become a very important, you know, a critical problem, and that indeed the entire country has become much more aware of it, and it's trying to find solutions for it. So climate change is more only sort of embellished into that general picture. But I think that's sort of the challenge to the Chinese leadership, to think about how to really communicate to the general public that these things are not only critical to the, you know, to the global future, but also to the Chinese people themselves. And to communicate that knowledge and to ask people to, you know, make some sacrifices that's probably necessary in order to be able to reduce the kind of emission and to be able to solve the problem. I think that's, you know, a huge challenge. But at the same time, I think in order for them to persuade the people in developing countries, they also need the partnership that's been talked about in developed countries. Because I think it'd be very hard sell for them to tell Chinese people saying that, okay, you should not do this or do that. But when they look at the consumption pattern, the consumption behavior in other parts of the world, you know, in a totally different, you know, a different pattern, and you know, the consumption is much many times more than the general public in China, I think that's a very hard sell. So I think the political leaders in the developed countries should also face up with the challenge to communicate with the public here also about the possibilities, about, you know, how people can change behaviors. And also, as, you know, Ralph said, that to how to find solutions that actually can benefit both the developed countries and developing countries.
Paul, I don't want to tax your voice too much, but you referenced the, you know, the Google search of leadership. I think a couple of those would have been mine anyway. But if we go ahead and create another body, a Leaders 14, and you get people to the table and they sign on and they say, we're willing to look at this, we will acknowledge the need to do something, how do you prevent it from being little more than a PR exercise that says, look at us appearing to do something? How do you guarantee that it delivers?
With respect, I think that's a bigger concern for the media than it would be for the leaders. There's been a kind of conventional wisdom which has grown up that G8 doesn't do anything, they just get together for photo ops, and I'm afraid it's not true. They actually do things. Most of the work that we've done on terrorism began back in, 1988 even, in Halifax. The same thing for the increasing aid efforts in Africa. I mean, it's very easy to be cynical. But at the same time, I don't think it's warranted. I don't think you would get 14 or 15 or 20 leaders around a table who would just come for the photo op. They got a lot of other things to do. So I don't actually see that as a problem. What I see is the solution to the problem. Is that they get to they start out with the presumption that it's all that there is a real problem, and they start to identify the extent to which each of them can move on that problem. They start to understand better what the political opportunities and the political constraints are, and they start to come to some kind of a decision. So if we ever got to the point where we have G8 meeting, I think, or G15, L15 meeting on climate change, we would have narrowed the differences between us enormously, and we could do much further. I used to think, and I still think I was correct, that we could have had a much more successful UN reform program if there had been an L15 that had got together first and said, here are a few things that we think need to be done, and we all agree, and we commend it to the rest of you. That's leadership. That's leadership and partnership. By the way, in Google, partnership got 204 million entries, which shows that it's more important than leadership.
Rolf, in consideration of the fact that I know you have to leave the panel in a few minutes, and I see you've been scribbling as well, I'll let you weigh in on this. The notion, let me throw something on the table as well, though, that if you get these people to the table, the L14, it's a meaningful dialogue. Everyone is there with genuine intentions. Angel talked earlier about the idea of taxing the bad. Is that kind of an approach likely to get through this body, or is that something that they would all have to do independently?
No, I think a dialogue, partnership, these are all very important principles. And before you come to a joint decision, I think a dialogue produces, hopefully, if it's a real dialogue, a common understanding. And a common understanding means not just the technical aspects. It's not a question of whether I can really explain what an emission trading system means. It would also say, is it feasible, for example, in my country to do it? And if I say no, it's perhaps not yet, the institutional setup is not yet there, I would hope that the other one would understand that, well, then maybe we have to make another combination of instruments. And I think one should not set sort of or think that a group of such leaders would mean uniform results and measures to take. I think it would mean that countries will have to come up at that table with their own ways to do it. I mean, countries have very different social, historical, economic systems, political systems. So it cannot be that we just say, there is a concept, I know what it means technically, how to get there, and then everybody does the same thing.
If I can interject on that point, though, I mean, how likely is that to be something you can sell when you get back home, that what seems reasonable around the table, with everyone trying to be very open to the idea that they have different systems and different advancements and different sort of appreciation of the problem, but you get back home, you have to sell it politically. If it appears that somebody won and somebody lost, doesn't it all fall apart?
Well, let me then say, there are two things that I would say. First is, yes, deals have to be balanced. They cannot be unilateral. And they cannot just mean someone loses and the other one wins. And in climate change, I think it is obvious that everybody will gain if there really is an efficient policy to stop it. So the gains are not even questioned. The question is how to get there. And you know, when you say, is it difficult to sell at home? I think if you see how the OECD, just one of the many international institutions, but after all, a club, a bit bigger than 8, a bit bigger than 15, 30. But nevertheless, when you see what it means for politicians who have to sell what you say, sometimes very unpleasant reforms, and they can go and say, well, look at this at home. Other countries do this and that. They take such measure. And why do they do that? Because they want to be keeping up with everybody else. I think you get a very good argument, in fact, to do things at home because you know that everybody else is also moving along. And it's important. You know, the OECD speaks very often of this principle of a peer review, no? Peers, a small group of people get together and they look at each other. I think it's even a selling point for reform, not just in climate change, much more generally speaking. If you can have, as a politician at home, the argument that this is done elsewhere, and if we don't do it, we're falling behind. Maybe we save a few of those economies today, but tomorrow we'll have to pay even more. So the group is not only an instrument to really raise understanding, it's a group that can agree on principles. And next year, 6 months later, when they come back, they will have a chance to say, have you delivered? Have you delivered what you promised? Have I delivered? And as Paul was saying, the worst is, of course, if someone says, okay, we've agreed, but it's not for me to do it. And 6 months later, you come back and nothing has happened. And Paul was saying, 10 years later, we're coming back and nothing has happened. I would say it's a reason for a certain lack of confidence. And if I end on this note, when you see today in the real world how this group of G8 and O5 gets together, you can see that they have to overcome certain lack of confidence. They have to overcome it. And how do you do this? By being serene, serious, and deliver. Then I think you can create that atmosphere of empathy and of trust that then allows you to say, yes, I will make a step because I know you also will provide a step towards the common goal.
Thank you, Andres.
I wanted to perhaps say a couple of words on the realities of this issue, of the climate change issue. Here the international community did get together, did approve a blueprint for tackling climate change, for reducing emissions, signed the protocol, and what happened afterwards is best described as pin the blame on the donkey. The industrialized countries, especially the United States, decided that they wouldn't do anything because the developing countries didn't take on the commitments. Developing countries said, well, we're not going to do anything because it's all your fault to begin with. So either you pay for it or we're not doing it. Of course, in the meantime, we see the results of not doing anything. Now, it's, for me, clear that when you do get these mechanisms, you call them institutions or bodies. I don't think they should be institutions or bodies, but mechanisms for dialogue to work. You go somewhere, and I'll give you a very concrete example. 2 weeks ago, less than 2 weeks ago, in Berlin, there was a meeting of the Sherpas of the G8 with the O5. And among the issues they discussed was climate change. And at the end of that meeting, there is now a common paper, which is a chairman's summary of the discussions, which reflects an agreement on certain of the key issues which have been blocking an agreement. There is an acceptance of some of the principles that each of the two sides have been asking for, demanding. Well, that's a stepping stone to go to the next step, where you take that and you begin to look at some of the specifics. And that presumably will be done between now and the G8 summit in Japan, where the five will participate in a greater role, some greater role, we don't know exactly which greater role, than they did in Heiligendamm, at St. Petersburg, or at Glen Eagles. So the work that we've been doing, the work that CG's been doing, the work that the Center for Global Governance in University of Victoria in BC has been doing, and this group of Breaking Deadlocks, is not in vain. It's not just there and in abstract. There is, in effect, movement by governments that you can measure. I can measure it, and seeing where we were 5 years ago and where we are today. We haven't gotten there yet. We may not get there in the next year or two. But I still go back to the same issue, the cost of not doing anything, both for one side and for the other side, is going to be immensely larger the longer we wait.
But in this room, you're preaching to the converted. There's nobody here.
Converted.
It's, you know, this is my role. This is my comfort zone. I just play the other side. But I mean, you're preaching to the converted. And in certain countries now, you may be preaching to the converted. But clearly, there isn't a consensus either on whose problem it is to fix, whose fault it is to begin with, or even on the timeline to do something. The level of urgency is really just, you know, even in North America, a debate that's just starting to kind of pull in the same direction. So even when everyone here agrees, what is the reality out there in the world that you're all familiar with based on current careers and past? I mean, how real is the acceptance? Or is it just that you see everybody else is signing on and you think it's prudent to do the same thing, but nobody does anything after that?
You're privileged, Diana. You live in a country that has been environmentally conscious for some time. I come from a country where there was no environmental, where there was no environmental consciousness for most of the period that I grew up. And the result of that is, if you see what the consequences are in terms of disease, in terms of stunted growth, in terms of malnutrition, in terms of all of the issues that environmental damage causes, you come to the conclusion that you have to do something about it. And if you travel, as many of my countrymen do, and come to the Canada or to the United States or go to Europe or to Sweden, and they see the difference between what their country has and what these countries have, they're convinced. And I say they're convinced to pay an additional cost. Every Mexican has to pay, every Mexican who owns a car, which admittedly is not every Mexican, but a good number of Mexicans, have to pay an additional cost for that car not to pollute the way cars used to pollute. And the additional cost is quite high, but they're paying it because they believe, and I think that this is what environmental consciousness is about, they believe that they will be better off if they live in a cleaner environment than if they live in the pig pen that we used to live in. And I would venture to say that China and the Chinese people and India and the Indian people will eventually get to that point as well. Why? Because they will see directly in their lifestyles the negative effect of not doing it.
Gordon?
Well, I just, Diana, want to make a distinction between two things because they're becoming blurred a little bit. One is that there is a huge set of issues out there in the climate change and energy area that need to be tackled. And what the sort of nature of that negotiation might look like to try to come up with a win-win deal. And then couldn't leaders of the key countries play that role? But there's a broader issue here. And indeed, several people have referred to this project. We've in fact had 16 meetings, I think, on different subjects, from nuclear proliferation to through to infectious disease. And I think it's the feeling of those, or most of those that have been involved, that more broadly a different mechanism is required. And I think, you know, it may be that this new mechanism will be struck not in response to climate change and energy, although I think there's a good chance it will be. But if an avian flu suddenly really broke out, and there was a global emergency that required international cooperation to deal with it, somebody could think about calling this kind of enlarged group of countries together to deal with it. So I don't want people here just to think that there's a necessary and sort of equal in all respects connection between solution to the climate change energy set of issues on the one hand and this enlarged summit on the other. The latter is a bigger issue about how we deal with an increasingly interdependent world.
Paul?
I'd like to say a word in defense of politicians, or at least leaders. People who seek that office, obviously there's ambition involved in it. People, you know, it's a greasy pole. People want to get to the top, just like they want to get to the top of whatever their pole they're climbing. But also they want to do something. I think that's what the significant thing of public office is. They want to make things better. And a technique which brings leaders together in a circumstance where they're looking at the same problem, understanding what the political limits and the difficulties each other has, I think gives them an opportunity to achieve things. So I think the leaders are going to want, and I don't think you're ever going to get to a, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's faulty in understanding of democracy, I don't think we're ever going to get to a situation where all the people in China and all the people in India and all the people in Brazil and all the people in Canada and the United States have all come to a consensus that now we have to do something about climate change, because when we get to that consensus, we're not going to be here anymore, I don't think. So it's up to the leaders to point the direction, and that's what they do. And sometimes it requires making unpopular decisions. I remember Brian Mulroney saying that no leader should leave office popular, and certainly he fulfilled that objective better than practically anybody.
I wanted to ask Rolf, in the discussions that we had today and yesterday and the night previously in Toronto, listening to those discussions, from my perspective, I didn't hear the name of one country or one leader come up over and over again as being on the leading edge, as having taken charge on this particular issue. Today I heard reference to Norway. My narrow political experience would tell me that they may not be the one to lead the charge. But is there, from what you see at OECD, a country, a leader, someone who seems to be able to get this kind of consensus, pull people together, that is the one who could lead this forward?
I agree. I think it is very often a question of personality, of capacity to bring together, to pull together. And from time to time, as history shows, these kind of people emerge. But I don't think that they can be grown on trees so that you just take them off when you need them. On the other hand, though, I think if you allow for places to exist or you create them, such as this one, you create a space in which people, even if they are by themselves, not all great leaders, but where people get together and in a collective way take responsibility. I think it's very important. Surely there are personalities that can replace for a certain time certain platforms. But more generally, I think, and in line with what I would call democratic values, I think we should be not going for too much of leadership of that sort. I think we should go for leadership that is in a institutional framework possible, it's encouraged, it should happen. But that means you have to think about it, what is the right framework for such a decision making. And I would add that when you see countries that are emerging and still emerging on the global scene, despite all the closeness that we have, we can fly everywhere, we can be everywhere anytime. If you look at yourself, you can see that you still have your own ideas, your values, your background. And that, I think, is something which, in a process where you have to decide about policies in individual countries, has to be valued. Respect the other. Make sure that you do not believe that this is just interest. Respect. And that has to be grown in places where people talk to each other. And I have to say, I couldn't agree more with what some of my colleagues here said. The internet will never replace that sort of a personal encounter that you have.
Oh, but the BlackBerry will. So.
Yes, of course.
I'd like to pick up from Ralph's point. I agree that actually I think that the problems we're facing, it's not like the event like this, you know, Second World War, like 9/11, like a crisis situation, where I think the situation creates leadership. What we're facing are the problems that sort of, you know, with accumulating over the times. And the risks, you know, are, you know, far away. You don't feel the immediate, you know, problems and so on. So I think this kind of a situation, you know, creates requires different kind of a, you know, leadership that, you know, would really have to be somewhat more collective, somewhat more gradual. And so here I think the key is how not to play the blame game, but rather to find creative solutions. And one thing that, some of the things that, you know, this morning has been talked about technology. I can see that indeed there are many opportunities there that actually there could be institutional innovations. For example, could we have given the technology, the best technology available, and given what's being used in many developing countries, is it possible to create a global technology foundation that pays the companies to get the technology, the best technology, and then use that to diffuse it and find ways to diffuse that to the developing countries? Because if you follow the natural economic evolution, the developing country will not be able to use those technology, probably at least in 20, 30 years. But with that sort of a, you know, global technology fund, maybe they can use that immediately. That will cut the emission. That will increase the energy efficiency tremendously. So I think there are many of those sort of win-win solutions that actually we may have not really, you know, sort of worked worked hard enough to try to find.
It actually brings me to one of the questions I'd written down earlier when we were listening to Steve Strong, and I believe it is from Goldman Sachs, and he was talking about the idea that maybe another way to go at this is to put enough money into the R&D, come up with X technology that is so persuasive in of itself that countries all want to bring it in because it appeals to their competitive advantage, that this thing spreads, not unlike the BlackBerry, around the world and becomes a tool that you must have. That, other than a kind of political will to do something, whether it's taxation or changes to environmental policy, that could help fix the problem. How real is that, Gordon?
Well, I'm cautious on this, and I guess it's maybe after having spent 3 decades working in the government of Canada, government's capacities to pick winners, particularly in the technology field, is not good. The marketplace does a lot better. So it seems to me, coming back to the previous discussions today, the critical thing is to get the marketplace working, and so that there is competition, and you know, may the best products win. One then has to find ways, in some cases one has to find ways, as Lan has just said, of facilitating technology transfer in such a way that those that have developed the technology are rewarded for it, but still find some kind of technology transfer. But for the last 10 years, I've had the privilege of serving as the chairman of the International Development Research Center. Maureen O'Neill, the president, is here. And the IDRC is founded on the basis...
Gordon, I'm just going to interrupt just for the moment to say that Rolf has to leave us to catch his plane. So I want to thank you for your participation, Rolf.
Really, just I was almost done. I just wanted to say that what the IDRC was created for was to help developing countries find technology solutions to the problems that they have. That is very good. I mean, it can't be just a matter of transfer of technology. It's the development of technology in the South, and there are a lot of things that we can do in the North to make that happen. But the best thing, though, is, as I repeat, in my view, is to be very cautious about governments trying to pick what the best technology is and funding it. It'll be one mistake after another.
I want to pick up on one thing that, again, you know, as a journalist, is the worst possible scenario, which is that everyone on your panel agrees. And you just keep moving the conversation around, and there's no friction, no resistance, which is, you know, the moment television is made for. If everyone here agrees on the need for leadership on this issue, that the mechanism may be still, you know, a bit rough on the edges, but there's a general thinking about the way to move forward, then is there anything on this issue that you don't particularly agree on that is still sort of stopping forward progress?
I didn't agree on leadership, still.
But you weren't very aggressive with that, Paul. If you could,
you want me to be aggressive?
That'd be great.
Okay.
Do that.
I can do that too. Maybe not when I'm this sick. I think I was more than just trying to be entertaining on the business of partnership, because we've got, you know, the world's had a lot of leaders. Genghis Khan, there are a lot of leaders that perhaps we would not want to be following. And when you were saying we should identify a country who's going to lead, well, the obvious candidate would have been the U.S., but, you know, they were leading us on this issue, not at all. But that's where I think sensible people have to come together. But I don't know. I can disagree with Gordon on the U.N. if you want. Gordon, I think that you're...
On the UNFCCC?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, absolutely. It was already working and accomplishing things before most people understood it even existed. I mean, it goes back to, you can go back to that chart we saw with Jacquard, with, you know, the conservative government of Brian Mulroney was already taking steps and was holding climate change conferences back in the 80s. So, and that was all happening in the UN. If you want to talk about it, there's an international legal regime. It's based on the UN charter. There's 70 to 100, Louise, I'm not sure how many, environmental treaties that exist. They're UN treaties. on environment. There are treaties on terrorism. There are treaties on human rights. That's how we govern ourselves. We don't ask a bunch of guys to get together and tell us, you know, what the hell's good for us. All I'm saying is it's going to be work better if you have people who have a format where they can get together, the people with the biggest problems, and start to sort some of them out, and then they can commend that kind of consensus to the larger membership. But if you think you can impose it on the larger membership, then we're going to, you know, climate change will have changed. People with mountaintop properties on the coast of British Columbia are certainly going to have waterfront properties.
This could be good news for some of us. But Paul is missing my... I am not arguing that the UN isn't a vital body and isn't
microphone.
The appropriate legal body.
We want to hear every word.
I am not. I'm saying that the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change negotiating process will not get us there. And I would also argue with you, I guess, on Kyoto. And I do this with some reluctance, because at this point, Paul was working for me and he labored very hard.
That's right.
To achieve on Kyoto. But look, it was clear the United States was never going to accept. The resolution in the Senate came out immediately afterwards, where it was 95-0 or something like that. I mean, even if Kyoto had been followed by the countries that had signed on the limits, that wouldn't have got us there. I don't know a climate change expert that thinks that the Kyoto trajectory would have been adequate.
No, of course it wasn't adequate, but it was a start.
Yeah.
And so far, we haven't done anything. No, well,
we haven't
the Europeans
either.
Have.
I was going to find out how good a diplomat you really are, Andres. You're sitting in the middle.
I'm a physical barrier here. Elizabeth is in the room back
Elizabeth
there
Dowdswell
somewhere,
right there, yeah.
Elizabeth Dowdswell, and she might. Why don't you come up here and join us instead of Rolf and join the debate, because this is a debate in which you were a very clear and very important part. Come up, really. But what I was hearing Shuilan talk about how do you convince Chinese people that they need to alter their expectations. I won't say they need to alter their lifestyles. They need to alter their expectations of lifestyles. A flippant thought came to mind. Leadership is perseverance. I think one of the characteristics of leadership is perseverance. And I'll come to something which is relevant to Jim Balsley and Rim. Jim went to China about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, to try to convince the China mobile telephone company that they needed to start marketing BlackBerries in China. And the answer basically was no. And now, just a couple of days ago or so, he has finally entered the Chinese market. So when Jim sells his 300 millionth BlackBerry in China, just in China, and each BlackBerry has a message at the top telling the user that he has to modify his expectations, that the BlackBerry is a wonderful thing, but that he's not going to be able to have everything that he wants, and then we'll be on our way. Elizabeth, why don't you...
If I could ask you to introduce yourself to the audience, and just before you start, if you don't mind, I wanted to know, I can't see any roving microphones in the audience. I'm not sure if they're available to us or not.
No, they're there.
There is, okay. We'll get to that in just a moment.
Thank you, Diana. And I'm not sure why Andres wanted me up here.
Know something.
My experience has, like some of my fellow panelists here, been in the United Nations system. But it started in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was at one point Canada's lead representative for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and then the lead negotiator on climate change for the Framework Convention, and then worked in the United Nations as head of the United Nations Environment Program. It's rather interesting, 2 points I would make, one that I'll make tomorrow, which is that it's fascinating to find yourself on the one hand, trying to help develop a global regime to combat climate change, and more recently, trying to help our own government with the challenge of what we're going to do in this country for 100,000 years or more with respect to nuclear waste. The two have come together in ways that would never have been predicted before. So that's one thing. But the other comment I would make, and it's to agree with both Gordon and with my friend to the right here, Paul, right, is that that leadership and partnership are both necessary. You see how hungry the world is for that kind of leadership, but it is leadership that is both empathetic and also is looking for those kinds of partnerships that are going to make things work. The one contribution that I'll try and make tomorrow when we're talking about nuclear is that although the primary focus in many discussions is around technological questions, whether we can get there fast enough, for example, or economic questions, as we saw in the panel earlier, and I just want to leave you with the notion that there's also a question of whether we're even going to have the social license to operate in many of our countries. And so the questions in this world of difference and indifference, I guess, we need powerful instruments of governance. We need certainly a very positive and productive economic systems for both developed and developing countries. But as much as anything, we need caring, ethical human beings and their institutions who actually decide that they really care about the people on this planet that they want to live with and the environment in which they live. And so in that sense, I can agree with the most positive and altruistic things that all of the panelists have said.
I want to move the conversation now to our audience, so I would ask that you put your hand up, and I recognize this gentleman here first, and we'll try to move it around the room, and I see this gentleman as well. We'll do this for about 20 minutes to get us roughly back on schedule. I would ask then that in the interest of time and trying to get everyone to ask a question, that you direct your question to one person on the panel.
Yes, my question, I guess it would be to Paul. I think we're talking about a log jam here, and Canadians know about log jams. I.e. nothing happens, and then all of a sudden something happens, and there's sudden change. If, for example, Mr. Gore was elected president of the United States in November, is that not a significant change, i.e. the logjam gets broken?
I'm particularly like that question because it gives me a chance to go back and attack Gordon Smith again. I think it would make a big difference if Gore suddenly found himself as the presidential candidate and the president in 2008. I think it would have made a big difference if he'd been the president and he was the president in 2000, but if he had actually got the office as well. At Kyoto, he was the one who bid up the reductions on the U.S. side and drove the numbers as high as they actually got. And in fact, they got so high that the Canadian government started to not follow suit. So I think if he had been president, it's one of those things that would make a big difference. I think people make a difference. I don't think that he himself, he doesn't have 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, but in a circumstance in which he was president, especially one in the next round, you could expect probably quite a bit of people, like-minded people, getting elected at the same time in both the Senate and the House. So I think that would change things. And I do think it was George Bush who was the blockage. And in his simply saying that it's not good for the U.S. economy, so he wouldn't do it, I thought that was pretty close to the opposite of leadership.
I'll take a question from this side of the room first. Lady at the back with her hand up.
Thank you. I hear a lot of country naming. And I was just going to say that part of the empathy goes towards thinking that we are one species, that we are one people. And I guess the emphasis on leadership makes me to think that what about individuals? We all have responsibility. The Time magazine called the person of the year you because of a lot of vehicles on internet that gives individual power. So I was going to talk to Paul and say there is a fabulous document that was UN initiated, the Earth Charter. And the Earth Charter finishes, I'm just going to read this. Let Earth be a time remembered for the awakening of a new reverence for life, the firm resolve to achieve sustainability, the quickening of the struggle for justice and peace, and the joyful celebration of life. And in it, the Earth Charter International asks for legally binding agreements that countries have to abide by. I don't see how a leadership of L15 would be able to enforce the things that we need to do in the view of the fact that both the oceans and the soil are saturated with carbon. We only have the air to work with, and that's the urgency.
Did you want someone in particular to respond?
Well, I thought maybe Elizabeth Dowdswell, who was there. Well, I was there too, but she maybe has a better memory than I do. The issue about the L15 or the L20 or whatever it is not that they're going to impose anything on anybody, because, frankly, they can't. They may be the most powerful countries in the world, but they can impose things on people. But if they can agree among themselves on something that needs to be done and they commend it to others, then you're a long way down the road. If you can get the Indians and the Chinese and the Americans and the Europeans and so on to agree on a course of action and they commend it to the rest of the membership to do, you've got more than half the problem solved. And even if the rest of the membership didn't do anything and the 15 did something that they agreed among themselves in climate change, that would be major, major progress. So I don't see an L15 as a way, as in some sense replacing the UN. It doesn't trouble me at all. One of the things I would say is that while we have in Canada a kind of general appreciation of the UN, we don't have a very specific appreciation of the UN. And what I mean by that is when I sat on the Security Council, I didn't have any doubt that the Americans took it deadly seriously, that the Russians took it deadly seriously, that the Chinese took it deadly seriously. It's only in sort of cafe talk and a beer after the game that people are so critical of the UN. It is the place where international peace and security is decided. That's what the Security Council is for. It doesn't always succeed because it reflects the differences among us and among, the world at any given time. But this L15 is not going to replace it, and there's no risk of that ever happening, in my judgment.
There's a gentleman over here who put a notepad up very early on, so I'll let you.
Well, I'm Olivier Giscard d'Estaing, and I am president du comité pour un parlement mondial. Et rien que ce titre vous montre ma question. Is it possible, do you think that the political leaders are in a position to find the solutions for world issues? What I mean, those leaders are in charge of their nations, not of the global. And I don't think any country accepts the leadership from other countries within their own countries. So don't you imagine the possibility of having a world leader which is not a chief of state? You know, in Europe we have a special institution, and United Europe is a model of multilateral institution. Then we may think that we could have an institution aside from the United Nations dealing with the global problems and global issues we have in a democratic way.
Well, I guess that's my question too. You want to take that, Gordon?
Well, I will take a stab at that, Olivier. I am an enormous admirer of what's called in French la construction européenne. I mean, the construction of Europe. But there are limits as to how far, certainly at this point, the European countries are prepared to go. And when you get to issues of security policy, when you get to issues of nuclear weapons, I haven't seen that Europe is near the point of giving to one person in Europe the decision as to when to use nuclear weapons. So I think if you look on a global scale, we're a long, long way away from there being sufficient consensus to give an individual or a group that degree of power. I mean, if one looks, and Paul is more expert in this than I am, or Louise, but if one looks at the veto on the Security Council and the difficulty even of restraining the use of the veto to substantive questions and not on procedural questions, it's very, very tough. So, I mean, I think in a perfect world, you're right. In an imperfect but the current world, I think what really one has to rely on is the leaders of the key countries. Paul Martin's original concept was of 20. I won't get into the detail of talking of why we're talking of a lower number now, but somewhere less than 20 but more than 10 that try to work out, as Paul has said, a position that they can agree to together, which is one of leadership in the world. It is not one of dictating to the rest of the world. I don't think we can get further than that politically now.
Can you get the microphone to the front? This gentleman standing here.
Thank you. From all the discussion, I have the impression that, or perhaps it's not correct, that Gordon Smith is proposing a G8 plus, a 14, 15... This is more or less the number of states which already now, not officially, but unofficially, is connected to this group of eight altogether. And after Heiligen Damm, the last summit, one could hear that in the next meeting there would be a more solid connection with these additional countries with the G8. So there is a development in this direction. The next summit will be in Japan, and perhaps this is one of the answers. Japan could do something for this development, unless you have in mind to create a totally new mechanism, and then a lot of questions will start. But may I just add one word? I think we should not overestimate the importance of friendly relationship between leaders. It is true that it facilitates, but at least from the European experience, where we have 27 heads of state getting together quite regularly, when it comes to essential things, or what they consider to be essential, like have a common flag or have a common anthem, then you will not get an agreement in spite of all their friendship.
Gordon, is the momentum already there within the G8?
I hope so, but let me just say why I'm not sure that it is. Certainly everything you said, Hans, is correct. Andres has talked about this. The 8 plus the 5 are meeting. I asked, are the 8 sitting together and the 5 towards at the other end of the table? No, they're sitting equally around the table. These things matter. So the easiest and most obvious way forward would be the formalization of that group. But my impression, your neighbor Tanaka-san may have his own views that he wants to express on this, but my impression is the Japanese are very far from comfortable with this and may well want to roll the process back further than where the meeting went at Heiligen Damm. So, I mean, I don't regard it by any means as certain. The other issue that we've raised, just to be clear of it, is should there be, I mean, we've involved Egypt in our meetings. Should there be an Islamic, particularly an Islamic Middle Eastern country that would be part of this reconstituted group? One can argue that. We now have Hillary Clinton with another option altogether, and that is an E8. Eight countries, unclear who they are, who are the most important environmental countries, which takes you then into, and I won't spend a lot of time on this, sort of variable geometry, changing groups. And there, by the way, I think the most important thing to say about that is what you will lose, as several of us have talked about, is this development of empathy, which you've mentioned yourself, Hans, which is so important to actually reaching agreement on these at these actual meetings.
Actually, ask the microphone come back just for a side. Hans, was it this gentleman had his hand up as well?
Thank you. My questions are
I'd ask you to speak up if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah. I'm Alag, and my question is addressed to Paul and or Gordon, both, either one of them or both of them. I empathize with a lot of what has been said in terms of procedures and people getting to know each other. But unless you understand the language of the other, I don't see, and the question of empathy that was raised at the beginning.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Unless you understand.
Hold the microphone closer if you don't mind.
Okay. Unless you understand the language of the other, the conceptual basis, the thinking and the language of the other, I don't see much progress going on. And I'll give you a simple instance. Doha, you've had pretty much the 14 going on agriculture. In 2004, in a SIGI meeting, I said that, you know, there are issues on which we have walked out. And before Doha, there was the Committee on Agriculture. The chairman had done precisely, he had the note that Andres talked about. And incidentally, I got a copy of that note before I came also. Now, the point is that Doha has not been solved up till now. The agriculture business, in 2004 we raised these issues. And even up to today, there is no progress. And we've gone through a fairly inclusive process. We initiated the group of 20, which was the developing countries, went up to the group of 33. The four, precisely something corresponding to the four, the five, and the 14 has been going on Doha. And there is no agreement on that. Energy and agriculture are serious issues. On technology or on lifestyles and strategic changes, India and China are raising those issues. And unless you meet them head on, I think simply talking about negotiating styles and, better personal relations are not the issues. The issues are of a very different nature.
In the interest of time, I'm going to ask Andres, actually, if you wouldn't mind speaking to that.
Well, I go back a little bit to the progressive perseverance issue. It's true, there are many issues which have not been solved. Doha is one of them. I would say partly because there is a lack of leadership. Within, or a lack of involvement of the leaders. This is being left to technical negotiators to try to come up with an agreement. And we all know, those of us who have participated in international negotiations, that if you leave the same people negotiating long enough, they will eventually reach an impasse because they each sit on their positions and they don't want to move. But the perspective I see this from is the subtitle to CG's name, and that is Building Ideas for Global Change. We need to change. If we keep on doing things the same way we are doing them, we will not get anywhere. And I think that the whole idea of the L14, 13, or whatever, is to change the current system of global governance. Now, governance doesn't mean imposition. It doesn't mean not listening to the Indian position or to the Chinese position. It means trying to find a way through that meets the basic positions of the countries. And this is what I think, if you saw the note, if you saw the chairman's summary, it begins to do. It recognizes one of the basic principles that India and Brazil and China and Mexico have and South Africa have been fighting for, which is the proportionate and differentiated responsibility. And then it goes on to say that you need to find a way for the developed industrialized countries to find financial mechanisms to help those countries in a differentiated and proportionate way. So, you know, I say we're not there yet, but I think we're further along in this particular path than we were 6 months ago or 12 months ago. And I would very much hope that Japan, as host of the next G8 summit, does not do what Gordon has said and go backwards on this process, because I think it is in Japan's interest, just as it is in every country's interest, to move forward and not backwards. And if Japan finds that it is not comfortable for some reason, I can't see why, but if it finds it's not comfortable with having Brazil and India and China and Mexico and South Africa participating in the preparation of the final communique and the negotiations of what's going to come out of the summit in Japan, we will in effect have gone backwards. And then we're not building for global change. We are regressing.
We have time for one last question. I've committed to this gentleman with his hand up here at the back, and then we'll let you go. I think they're ready for us back there.
Thank you. My name is Ernie Regeer, and I have a question for our guest from China, and to ask whether it's your sense that the L14 idea meets the requirements of those two characteristics of leadership, which are very interesting, that came out of the panel, and that is empathy and partnership. It strikes me that it's that the characteristics that are still most prominent are those of influence, prominence, capacity. But what about the issue of empathy, which means taking the perspective of the Dinka herd boy in southern Sudan, who is really in the vanguard of bearing the burden of climate change already? Is it your sense that the empathy and partnership qualities are going to be present in that kind of a body, or are there other elements required?
Quite sure.
Okay, I guess what you're talking about is the two keywords of empathy and partnership in terms of leadership. How Chinese leadership is demonstrating it in Sudan's case. Well, I think, first of all, I have to say that I don't know the situation in Sudan that well. But I think in terms of the Chinese government's approach in many of these sort of internal conflicts, of other countries, I think the general approach Chinese government has been trying to use, persuasion, and more softer approach. This is precisely because Chinese government themselves, if you look back at Chinese history early part of the 20th century, Chinese government themselves have suffered from the international bodies, trying to, impose on things in solving the internal conflicts. And also in terms of relationship, later with the Soviet Union. So Chinese government, I think the insistence on trying to use persuasion and other more softer approach, there is that sort of historical road, that, has been advocated for, by the Chinese government. So I believe that has been the approach that has been, used by China in the Sudan approach.
On that note, I think we'll conclude the panel today. I would certainly say on a closing note that while we talk about the need for global political leadership and who's going to step up the plate, is it a country, is it an individual, is it a leader we're familiar with today or not, the one thing we can be sure about is there is indeed leadership, and we've seen it demonstrated by the people on the panel today. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you for your impromptu.
Just if I could have everyone's attention for one quick moment. I